This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, the province's PC leader is next in line on Dialogue, talking about the issues most important to Cape Bretoners. We'll talk to one of the latest pitchers drafted by the Minnesota Twins organization and his connection to Cape Breton, and an exhibit featuring a prominent Sydney-area landmark that's been here since the Cold War. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Nova Scotia PC leader Tim Houston weighs in this week on Dialogue, looking for your vote for the August 17th provincial election. Here he is in a recent conversation with Donnie Antle.
Mr. Houston, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So, of course, now I've been asking everybody this just because we are coming to the tail end of the pandemic. How was your experience with the pandemic over the past 16 months?
Yeah, we did. We did well in this province. We did what we were asked to do, and certainly for me as a political party leader, we decided early on that we would kind of get in line, follow public health, and support the government. Really, is what we did, because we knew the Nova Scotians wanted to. They needed to know that their community leaders, that their elected leaders, were all on the same page, and that was keeping them safe. So that's exactly what we did, and as a province, Nova Scotians did the same thing, and we did well. We followed public health, and we did well. So we're happy with that, and we're happy we got through it.
Okay. Now, your campaign, I see that health care is sort of a centerpiece of your campaign. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah, it's a centerpiece of our campaign because it's front and center on the minds of Nova Scotians. We have major issues in healthcare for sure, and a big question of this election is who can fix healthcare, like who can really get to work on addressing the challenges in healthcare, and that's what Nova Scotians have asked us to do. So that's what we've done, and we've been very honest with Nova Scotians. We started putting out we didn't wait for an election. We started putting out platform pieces a year ago on what we would do to support seniors. In last fall, we put out a very detailed policy on what we would do to support those Nova Scotians that need addictions and mental health support. And then in January, here in Cape Breton, we launched our Hope for Health plan, which talks about recruiting family doctors, talks about addressing the surgery wait times, and just everything in primary care. So it's been a big focus of ours. It's front and center in the minds of Nova Scotians. And really, the election comes down to who can fix healthcare and who can rebuild the economy. We put a lot of good, innovative economic ideas out there, too, to get our economy going. So I'm excited. I mean, the campaign's on. It's a great opportunity to get out and listen to Nova Scotians. I love that part of this role. And there's a lot we can do in this province. We have our challenges. We have to accept them and be honest about them. But by addressing the challenges, we can unlock the incredible potential that this province has. We have a lot of potential here. We just need the right leadership to unleash it.
This is true, and particularly here in Cape Breton, where both the healthcare issue is very acute and also the economic issues here are very acute as well. I'm actually going to skip ahead in my questions a little bit because I wanted to ask about the better paycheck guarantee and sort of population growth, some of those economic factors or features of your platform, if you could go into a little more detail on those.
Yeah, happy to. So fixing healthcare, addressing the needs in education and the needs that face the government, all these things take money. So you need to be able to build an economy to pay for them. So we can't do it overnight. We've been honest about what it's going to cost over the next 5-6 years to get things going. But very, very proud of the policy we put forward on the economy as well. In fact, leading economists in the country, when I went through the policy with them, they were like, wow, that's innovative. And one of them said it's the type of thinking that Canada needs. And basically, it's built on three pillars. And one is, more people, population growth, as you've noted. But we need more young people in this province. And we also have real big shortages in skilled trades. So we have a policy that says if you're under 30 years old and you're working in the trades, no personal provincial income tax in this province. We need young people going into the trades. We need young people that are in the trades moving to this province to help us build housing, build infrastructure, and people just making their lives here. So that's the first part, more people, more young people. The second part of the economic policy is more people earning more. We need to raise the wages of working families of this province. And that's what we've come up with. This is better paycheck guarantee. And under that policy, every corporation in this province, every corporation, whatever they pay in provincial corporate tax, we will give them half back on the condition that they give it to their workers. So not the 20%, what I call, not the people in the boardroom, the actual workers in the break room, the workers that are making things happen, the working families of this province would benefit from this. Because it's going to give the corporation a very simple choice. Either leave that tax money with the government or get it back and give it to your team. And I know what every time they'll choose the workers. That's what I would do, and that's what they will do, and that's what we would all do. So that's the better paycheck guarantee. And then the third part is more people earning more and spending it locally. So we want people to spend their money locally. We've come up with this idea of the Nova Scotia Loyal, which is just a loyalty rewards program. When you buy a locally produced or grown good or product, or you get points. And then you can redeem those points at things like Access Nova Scotia for renewing your driver's license. So more people earning more and spending it locally. That's our economic platform, and it's turning a lot of heads, but the better paycheck guarantee is a significant part of that.
It certainly is a very innovative approach, rather than... How do you feel about the idea of just raising the minimum wage? I know that that's something that has been discussed a lot by various groups.
Look, everyone in this province that's getting up and going to work has a right to expect that they can survive in this province. And right now, you know, housing's expensive, gas is going up, groceries are expensive, and people are struggling. So raising the minimum wage has a certain impact on a group of people, those that are, you know, in the minimum wage category. But the better paycheck guarantee is much broader than that. It will certainly help minimum wage people that are earning a minimum wage. It will raise their wages. But it's much broader than that, because we know that people in lots of economic categories or groups are struggling to afford housing. So the better paycheck guarantee is way more broad than raising the minimum wage. That's something that I think is really, really important. It's what I've heard from Nova Scotians traveling around. But people are struggling. The working families of this province are struggling. And we're looking for kind of innovative ways that will support them but grow our economy. And I think when the government starts to think outside the box, think in innovative ways and bold ways, then other people take notice, and this will lead to companies coming here, will lead to people, companies growing here, which is going to help everyone. Minimum wage is very, very focused, very, very targeted. We need a lot more than that in this province.
And you mentioned, of course, housing costs. What is your plan for improving the housing situation? Because we are kind of in a crisis here in this province when it comes to affordable housing.
Yeah, absolutely. We're in a crisis, and we have been for a while, and it didn't just happen overnight. It happened because the government wasn't focused on it. They just weren't that concerned about it. So the answer to a housing crisis is more housing stock. We need more housing in this province. So there's a couple things that we're focused on there. And you know, a lot of people talk about affordable housing, but I talk about attainable housing, because it's across the whole spectrum. So we need more housing stock. So part of the thing that's holding that back is we don't have enough people building homes, right? That's that skilled trades shortage, which is causing problems. So obviously the initiative for the under 30 to get more people in the trades, that will help us address that. And the other thing that we're really looking at is to build housing and housing development, you need land. And sometimes land is a big impediment to starting a project. So as a province, as a provincial government, what I've said is that we'll look at the land that the province has. The province, Nova Scotia can't even really tell you what land they own right now. Like, it's just, so we got to get our hands around that. Look at the land we own, and then let's try to work with not-for-profit organizations anyone wants to build housing stock, we'll work with them and say, is this a piece of land that will be suitable for attainable housing? And how can we work together to make that happen? So there's a couple levers that the government can pull on, and that's where my focus is. Real solutions, absolutely real solutions to the issues, not just sound bites. And I know that a lot of people talk about rent control. I don't think rent control leads to more housing stock, and we need more housing stock. So that's why we're looking for real common sense ideas.
And back on land, you mentioned land, and you actually have a fairly extensive couple of planks in your platform concerning sustainability and the environment here in Nova Scotia. I was wondering if maybe you could elaborate on those a bit.
Yeah, I'm very, thank you for that, because I'm very proud of the PC party record on finding the balance. You know, there's always a balance we need to find, and politics is about branding, and often political opponents try to brand others in certain ways, but the PC party of Nova Scotia has a very good record on finding the balance and preserving our planet, and having a focus on preserving our planet. And you don't even have to take my word for it. I heard former Premier Stephen McNeil talking about how Nova Scotia has done well in things like emissions reductions, and he said that it was to do with 2007 legislation in this province that kind of worked as a roadmap on how to, you know, set a bunch of targets, and successive governments as followed. That was actually PC legislation. So we're very focused on preserving the planet, and that means you have to set targets, and the government has to hold itself to account to achieve those targets. So we're going to go back to that earlier PC legislation and renew those targets on how much land we should protect in this province. I've said it should be 20% by 2030, and just really be refocused on helping communities do what's right so we can collectively preserve the planet. It's really important.
And I realize I'm jumping around a bit here, but I want to go back to healthcare, because there was another sort of plank in your platform that really caught my attention, and that was sort of your solutions for the mental health crisis facing Nova Scotia and the idea of universal access to mental health care.
This is really important. I mean, we all know that the impact on families and on communities when somebody's struggling, so it's really important that they can get the care they need, and right now that's tough. I mean, if you're having to rely on the Nova Scotia Health Authority, you have a long wait list. 200 days, it used to be 300 days, might be back to that. I mean, it's just really difficult to get into care. And so what we've said is there's lots of resources in the province that can help. People that are qualified to help somebody, they don't all work for the Nova Scotia Health Authority. So they're in private practice, psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses with additional training, counselors, social workers, all kinds of people that are qualified to help. But they're not all in the health authority. So what we've said under our universal mental health care plan is we will mobilize the resources of the province for the benefit of Nova Scotians. So if you need help and you go and see somebody who's in private practice, we'll allow that person to bill MSI, to bill the province. Because our focus is on getting people help. And it doesn't matter to us where the person that's providing the help works. We just want people to get the help. So It's really that's some of the most progressive thinking around addictions and mental health support in the country, and I think this is something that you'll see happen in other provinces once we can do it here. So we're focused on getting people the help they need, and universal mental health is a way to do that. I'm proud of that solution.
And this would make Nova Scotia the first province to offer universal access to mental health care as well. So
yeah. It absolutely would, and it's like it's mental health is one of the areas where there's a two-tiered system. If you have money, if you have the resources, you can probably get the help. And we're gonna take that two-tieredness out of it and make it totally accessible for everyone. Universal mental health.
And just one more question, because I wanted to ask about long-term care here in the province. We have an aging population here in Cape Breton. So obviously long-term care is sort of another front and center issue here for my listeners anyway. And I was wondering if maybe you could elaborate on your position on long-term care.
Yeah, this is an area, it's an issue of concern across the province for sure. And it's definitely one that our CC candidate there, Johnny White, has kind of been really, really bringing to me early and often, for sure, because it is a big issue in the community. But a year ago, we put out our plan, Dignity for Seniors. And in that plan, again, we've been very open with Nova Scotians. There's a big investment that's required. But the bill is already sitting on the table. It's just that the government has happened to choose to look the other way and ignore it. We're saying we have the courage to pick it up and deal with it. We won't ignore it. So under our plan, we would, you know, we're prepared to build 2,500 new single rooms, so that everyone who wants a single room, not everyone does, you know, the majority of people want a single room, but for everyone who wants a single room, they would get one once we've done that construction. And so that's the first part of kind of the infrastructure. But then, of course, you need the team to provide the care to the seniors. So we know this. It's really tough working, you know, CCAs and our nurses working long-term care have it really mentally drained, physically drained. Oftentimes they're going to their shift thinking that, well, I probably won't be able to take a break today for lunch or bathroom because we're going to be understaffed as usual. So we need to support that. We need more staff. So we've said we'd hire 2,000 more to support professionals to work in there supporting our seniors. And, you know, that's a challenge, but we're up for that challenge. So we'll bring some more training in and stuff and really, really encourage people to get into the profession, which we can do once we spread the workload around. So we are ready to get to work solving the problems we face. And we're really the only party that's really talking in that way because we know that the solutions exist, and that's what we're focused on.
And, of course, sort of campaign statement that was made. Now we're talking about over $550 million in spending with a newly elected conservative government in Nova Scotia, but also the plan to balance the budget within 6 years.
Yeah, for sure. Like, look, we want to be very clear with people. Look, this is not an election cycle. I don't have a magic wand, but what I am focused on is moving this province forward. And we have to stop ignoring our issues. We need to address them and be straight with people about them. So we're being straight. After years of neglect, our healthcare system is broken. It is in crisis, and it is hurting Nova Scotians, and we are going to fix it. We are absolutely going to fix it. But, you know, as I said, we got to build the economy. So the better paycheck guarantee, the loyalty program, the investment in young people getting in the trade, those are investments in people. And this province will run deficits for a few years. We've said, you know, it's going to be 5 or 6 years under our plan. But we will deficits because we have to invest in people and we have to invest in infrastructure. But if we make the right investments, then we'll be much better off for it, not even in the long term, in the medium term. And that's what that's the message that we're sending to Nova Scotians. Pick the right government. Pick the government that is looking to the future and saying, we are willing to make the investments today in people and in infrastructure that can move this province forward in a big, big way. This is our time. This is our time in this province. We have everything that people want. We have a quality of life. We have post-pandemic. People have rebounded their quality of life. We have what they want, but they have to be able to access healthcare. They have to know that their kids and grandkids are going to get a good education, and they have to know that they can make a good career for themselves. Those are the investments that we're willing to make right now to seize on this opportunity. And I'm really, really excited about what's happening in the province. The slate of candidates we put forward and the vision we're putting to Nova Scotians is resonating in a big way, because we all want to move forward. We're tired of looking in the rearview mirror.
Very true. Thank you very much for your time today, Mr. Houston, and good luck on the campaign trail.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll be in touch.
Donnie Antle's behind the wheel again for this one. Up next, a remnant of the arms race through the lens of another familiar voice on Dialogue.
So we're here with Paul McDougall, who our listeners will know as the man behind The Good Sentence right here on Dialogue. And today the interviewer has become the interviewee because he has a very interesting photography exhibit that is on at St. Patrick's Church Museum right now. And Paul McDougall, welcome to your show. How's it going?
I knew you'd want to say that. I'm very glad to be back on my show with you. Another great interviewer on Dialogue.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Yeah.
So, first of all, this photography exhibit, this is absolutely fascinating to me because basically what you've done is you've taken a lot of pictures of the radar base from everywhere around Sydney, from everywhere where it's visible, which, as it turns out, is a lot of places. What inspired that idea?
Well, I'll tell you, it was probably somewhere in 2019 or early 2020. I just noticed on one or two occasions, like either while out biking around or in the car, that you could be at a certain spot, could be going up a road, down a road, around a curve or a bend in the road, and all of a sudden, boom, you'd see the huge white dome of the radar base, which is just at the top of Lingan Road, just on the outskirts of Whitney Pier, so high on the hill. And then I just thought, well, isn't that neat that thing is still there and you can see it, and then you just wander off and do the rest of your business, you forget about it. And then another day, you know, I'd notice it again, and then it became a kind of thing. I thought, well, how many different vantage points can we actually see the radar base from? So I started to really take notice and, you know, kind of go places to see where I could then see it from. And it ended up that you can see it from literally all around the CBRM, and all the different towns, many of the different towns and communities, into the countryside. And since the exhibit opened like 3 weeks ago, people have gone to it have been contacting me, emailing, saying, oh, you can see, like one friend of mine, Bill Davey, a retired English teacher from CBU, emailed me the other day, said there is one spot coming in Route 4 from East Bay. There's just one spot, and you're on the highway. And he said he always looks for it. You can see it. It's there, and then it's gone. So recently found out that you can see it from as far away as Kelly's Mountain. So these pictures didn't even make the exhibit. So I'm finding all these other spots. So it just became a thing. I thought, well, why don't I turn this into an actual photo project? I'll take pictures of them from all these different spots, either driving to places or while I'm out biking. I just take the bike with me. Simple enough to do that. And then if a vantage point comes up, I get a photo. So I took, you know, like hundreds of photos, but in the age of digital, that's great. It's, you don't have to print out hundreds of photos. And then my wife and I, we went sorted through them all. So we took all the pictures fall of 2020 over about 2 month period, and then started weeding through them, looking for really good ones, narrowed it down to about 25, 26 photos. And that's when I thought, wow, you know, you're looking at had to mount it. I did all that. I thought, I'm going to do it anyway, even though I don't know if I'll ever show it or where I'll show it, but I'm going to have it ready. So it'll be like a photo exhibit in the bag, right, ready to go. And then I talked to Joyce Rankin of the Old Sydney Society. Of course, you're very familiar with Joyce and what they do there.
Mm-hmm.
You help out a lot there yourself. And then she loved the idea, and then we turned it into the full-scale exhibit, which became even bigger than the photo project in and of itself. This is an interactive component and everything. And it's just been great. But it was just one of those oddball things, and I just thought, I'm going to go do this, and then we'll find a place, show it, and people are enjoying coming and talking about it. Yeah, so it's been really fun, and goes to the end of August, so there's lots of opportunity for people to go see it.
Excellent. And, of course, I got a chance to see the exhibit. And one of the things that really sort of fascinated about this project is the way that you present the photos. where you kind of have to guess where the photo was taken from and then check to see if your answer is correct?
That's right. What I did, another part of it also was I wanted to, get photos where you can see the radar base. And it's basically, in most of them, it's in the background, right? So the foreground becomes an important thing. So so part of my idea was to frame the photos in interesting ways with things in the foreground, but people might not be familiar with what's in the foreground. So the old Sydney Society was designing how we would display them, the idea was we'd have a card there with a little bit of a write-up, but it'd be folded over so people could look at the picture, and then you could, maybe it would know where it was. For instance, if there's a large ferry boat in it, you'll probably know that I'm in Newfoundland. But if it's in a really neat gravestone that actually looks sort of like the radar base, then you may wonder, I wonder where that graveyard is, right? And then you can look at them, try to figure them out. Maybe if you're with someone, and then you can flip them up and read about what they are. So that was part of it as well, because my idea was people could see these images, and then maybe through the summer you could make a thing of going out yourself to see, maybe recreate some of those places I was, or find different ones. Like I said, people have been telling me they've found different spots where they can see it from. And it's sort of starting taking a life of its own, because so many people are kind of interested in seeing places and figuring out some of the ones that I did them from and seeing their own. So it's become, it's really kind of taken off.
And that's another point too, like the idea of recreating some of your photos and finding some of these places. Now, I know the cemeteries threw me, because I think every cemetery I saw, I was looking at it and going, oh yeah, that's the cemetery that's up on the hill and the pier, and or just up behind, like up the end of Church Street, the church in Lingan there. And I was wrong every single time, because some of them was like, you know, there was the old Jewish cemetery that's up on McLeod's Hill and other places like that.
Yeah, that's right. So there's I've tried to get something in, like those ones, something in them that would help you figure it out. So there's one from one in Sydney, but if you've ever been to this one and seen this particular marker in that graveyard, right, then you would know where it was. But if you haven't, you can read where it is and then go there, because, you know, graveyards can be interesting places to visit on a day when you've got nothing to do. There's all kinds of different things people can do to pass the time, especially since we're getting out of COVID and all this other stuff, you know, there's more opportunities to just try to get out and do things. So one of them, you know, I took some of them from the larger sculptures down at the open hearth and at the former tar ponds, the park there, the coke oven site. Those are really neat sculptures down in and around there. Some people may have never gone to see them, or never, you can go up right close to them and look at them. And the one by Gordon Kennedy, the huge iron one, is really neat. And when you're close in there, there's a little road, you can go in and look at it. It's really something. So that's another thing I was trying to do, find a way that maybe people would then go out and look at some of these places and kind of leave their community, because I've and you can get out in the woods too. Like, for instance, this one from quite far away. I took it from Cox Heath Mountain. It took me three trips to, I go there a lot anyway, hiking, but it took the third time to get up there on a nice day when it wasn't cloudy, and you can see that. And then when I took all the photos on a camera, then I downloaded them onto an iPad to just, you know, frame them and that. And then I noticed that in the background you could see the Lingan, the windmills over there in Lingan, like we're behind the radar base. So it's like, not only was I focusing in on what I was, but you could, in your photos, then you can something else might show up there that you didn't really expect would be there. So so that's all part of it. So it really was neat. And then, of course, it was, you know, the whole thing of, you know, what the radar base actually is, the historical component of all that. That's all part of the exhibit as well.
And that's actually what I was going to ask you about next. What did you learn about the history of the radar base during this project?
Well, I tell you, it's pretty interesting. And if, for those that are interested in, you know, our local history as well as, you know, larger history or geopolitical history, the radar base played a large part of it because it's it came about in the 50s, the base there. And when I say base, I mean the whole, there was a community there. There were homes there and offices and all kinds of stuff. There was military and civilians, but that built up over many years. But it started in 53. But it was from the Cold War. And, of course, older people know what the Cold War is. Some of our younger listeners may not really. But it was after World War II, and then Soviet Union and U.S. Didn't become as friendly as they were during the war, and then there was all this aggression between the two, thinking there could be a war developed there, and possible missiles coming from over the Arctic through Canada to hit major U.S. centers. That's a short story version of it all. So the Americans wanted a system of radar defenses put in throughout Canada so that if that threat ever materialized, then they could send up fighter jets and blast them over Canada, of course. But which none of this ever materialized, but this defense system did. So, and there were actually three lines, one through the very high north, the high Arctic. That was called the Dew Line. Mm-hmm. That was probably the one most well known, the Dew Line, distant early warning. So that would be the first recognition of something happening. Then there was the Mid-Canada line, which literally went through the middle of Canada. And then there was the one, the radar base, Sydney radar base, CFS Sydney was part of. And that was called the Pine Tree line. And that kind of ran along the 50th parallel. So that's the lower part of Canada, you know. So if you look at a map, you know, the junction between Canada and the U.S. along there, that's where this line, there was over 20 radar base installations there. And ours was there. It started in the 53. They started working on buildings and then building the first radar dome, also known as the Ray Dome. And this was the thing that would send out signals into the air, bounce off anything that was there, and then send the signal back. And different ray domes or the radar buildings would detect different things. Some would detect height of an object. Some would detect speed. I believe some would detect the shape or the call signs on airplanes or something. So there were different features of each one. But the whole point of it was to say there was something in the air that shouldn't be there, and we have to do something about it. And so our base, there was anywhere between 200 and sometimes maybe up to about 300 people lived there, military and civilians. It was a little community unto itself, they had a curling club, which is still there and still used. Bowling alley, swimming pool, recreation hall, a couple of little stores, I believe, all kinds of stuff. So everybody, it was a community on the outskirts of Whitney Pier, which is part of Sydney. So it was like a community within a community within a community. On the top of the hill, it's part of NORAD, which is the North American Air Defense System. So that's what it was. And by the time they took down, you know, by the time the Berlin Wall was coming down and, you know, in the 80s and 89 and Glasnost and all that stuff with Russia, and by then Russia and the U.S. was all, the Cold War was kind of melting. So there seemed to be no need for these radar installations. So they slowly started taking them apart. And our base was finally decommissioned everything, and including taking down some of the radome buildings. Because at one point, there was three at one time, and I think there was a fourth one at one time as well. But there are old photos where you see the three of them in it, these big, large things. One of them was left. So in 1991, the whole place is closed, and then it gets turned over eventually to New Dawn Enterprises, which runs a housing cooperative kind of thing up there, affordable rent housing, which is cool, and I think they have a bit of a nursing home set up there. So that still survived. The Curling Club still survived, and One Raid Home still survived. And the deal more or less was when they took everything else down, they still needed some radar facilities on the east coast of Canada, and the deal was that one of those would stay. The one we're talking about, this one in Barrington down in Yarmouth. It's actually almost a sister to the one here, if you look at photos, and it's on a beach, and there's one in Gander, Newfoundland. Those are the three left, and they send out signals about 200 nautical miles in the air, and they cover all the East Coast, and that now is called the Coastal Air Defense, which, again, is still part of NORAD, but it's all automated, so all the messages, signals, all the electronic work and everything that would come in, and then it's all sent, through the internet and all this kind of stuff to North Bay, Ontario, where there's a huge underground kind of a bunker thing that's been there for decades, and that's sort of the command center for all this stuff. And they have, staff in there that read all this stuff and interpret the data, and so that continues on till today. That goes on there, so which is really, really neat. When we had the opening, there was a friend of mine came to it, Joe McGinnis, and Joe had told me when he was visiting an aunt or someone in Ontario as a little kid, they knew someone that worked there. And at that time, you could go in for a tour of it. And he said he didn't get all the way down to the bottom, but he remembers there are many levels, and going in there and just thinking what a really neat and interesting place this is. And
oh, yeah.
Most people don't know anything about it. You probably know something about it.
Well, yeah, my dad was he worked in the power plant section down in the official name for it at the time was the ROCC, the Regional Operations Command Center, but we all called it the hole. So, yeah, my dad worked in the hole for 3 years, actually.
Did you ever get to go down in the hole?
I did get to go down in the hole, as a matter of fact. I think I was about 13, and we got to tour the whole facility. At that point, they were starting to shut down some of the various operational areas down there. So, we got to see the whole thing. It's really, it's a bizarre place because it's like a three-story building, complete building, walls and everything, in a big hole underneath the ground. So,
yeah. It's, and you, at that time, you probably had no inkling that there was connected to what was going on in Sydney.
I kind of did because my dad is a pine tree line vet. So I was born in Penhold, Alberta, which was another pine tree line base. We lived in St. Margaret's. I'm not sure if dad ever served in Sydney or not, but we're intimately familiar with the pine tree line stations, for having lived on many of them over the years. And actually, this brings me to another question. Have you had any veterans from CFS Sydney come in and see the exhibit? And if so, what do they think of it?
I haven't heard myself if there have been any yet, but I did see on the old Sydney Society Facebook, there were a couple of veterans that had worked there were commenting about it. So I'm really hoping people that worked up there come see this, because it's a different way of looking at it and thinking of it many years after it's closed. And I'm sure a lot of people that work there probably don't think of it the way like I'm thinking of it now. So I'm, instead of the radar going out detecting things, instead I've used that as the centerpiece and I'm trying to see where I can see it from everywhere. So I think it will be really neat if you lived and worked there. People, you know lots more about it all than myself would find this kind of like a, you know, photography or art project or whatever you want to call it, right? They might find it really interesting to see, because they, of course, would notice it from places they are, but, you know, not everybody is going to bother to go out and take so many photos of it and try to arrange it into something. But I'm really glad I did, because from people that are going, they're liking it. And I'm hearing from other people saying they're going to go and stuff like that. And another thing what really struck me about it was it's the uniqueness of that structure, right? Not every community has one of those things. Like I said, there's only three left on the whole East Coast. So, you know, you may have a water tower somewhere or something, right? But, I mean, everybody's got those kind of things. So I kind of like the fact that CBRM has this unique thing. It's an artifact of the Cold War, or a relic, yet it still remains. It's still functional. Three military people work there to just make sure everything is working right. So it's still, you know, an active part of, you know, military defense of the country, silently sitting there, the top of the hill, doing its business, right? And you can see it from everywhere. And I'm sure many people, tourists or visitors, might see that when they're driving by somewhere and wonder about it and then just keep on going, right? And then the local people here, many never see it. It could be right in your plane of view. There's some pictures I took from around the Mayflower Mall, and unless you're really looking for it, you don't know it's there. But then when you do see it, you're probably going to see it every single time now that you go there. Planted it in your mind.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the main things about the exhibit is, of course, the idea that, you know, this is such a ubiquitous part of our visual landscape that we sort of becomes invisible to us, really.
That's exactly right. It's there, but it's become invisible to us, and it's been there, like, literally for 70 years, right? So that's another component of it all. You can take that a broader view of, you know, what else is in your community and or where you are, where you live, where you visit, that's there, but you don't see. You do see, but you don't see, right? The ubiquitous nature of it, or the mysterious nature of something that you've kind of long forgotten about, but maybe it still has a reason and a purpose, right? So I really found that kind of neat, because when I talk to people about it that haven't seen it yet, you know, they kind of get interested in it all, right? You know, it's just kind of a thing. We have it, so why not? And it's a fun thing, right? So you can, when you go to the Yale Sydney Society, when you leave, you can get a postcard-sized card, and they've turned it into a kind of interactive game thing. There's six of the photos on the front with little check marks, so you can go to the sites, try to find the six, right, that are on the card, pick them off if you've done, photobomb yourself maybe into a photo of one of them, or, you know, take a new photo and send it to the OSS on their email or Facebook, whatever, and then there'll be a contest later on into August, and there'll be some prizes, I think walking tour tickets and various things, and yeah, so we're hoping that people will submit things for that. And, you know, if you've got a day and maybe it's not a day for the beach, then you get two or three kids in the car, well, you could drive around and get a nice photograph with them somewhere. Go down to the Open Hearth Park and look at some of those sculptures there, right? You know, we tried to make it a broader thing as well, so that when the exhibit doesn't really end, and then you can add your own kind of part to it.
Excellent. So, Paul McDougall, thanks for your time today. The exhibit is called?
It's called Eye on the Pine Tree Line, and it's at St. Patch Museum down on the Esplanade in Sydney in the North End. And it runs, the St. Patch is opened 10 to 4 Tuesday to Saturday, so there'll always be student interpreter in there, so it's always open. And when people are in there, they should check out the Lego model of St. Pat's Museum that our own Donnie Antle spent months building.
Yes, they should. Absolutely.
They really should.
Yes, they should.
There's a lot of work in that. So you've got two reasons to go to St. Pat's.
Yep. Well, three reasons. St. Pat's, and Lego, and Eye on the Pine Tree Line.
Exactly. Because St. Pat's in itself, it's, you know, hundreds of years old. And it's even if we didn't have exhibits this in there, please go down and visit that.
Absolutely.
That is just such a great place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Paul.
Okay,
and we look forward to hearing the good sentence. And
for sure.
We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, take care, Donnie.
Yeah, you too.
They say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, certainly in this case. Sydney native Kevin McLeod grew up playing Little League here as a pitcher. He was drafted by the Oakland Athletics in the 1987 Major League Draft. His son Christian followed in his footsteps. The 21-year-old left-handed pitcher was recently drafted by the Minnesota Twins organization. Christian took our call from Alabama. The audio isn't the best as he's on a cell phone down south, but it was good enough to clearly hear his sincerity in saluting his father for helping him carve a path to the big leagues.
Yes, I know he grew up around Cape Breton area. I've played hockey and baseball and a couple other sports growing up and everything. And, you know, obviously baseball was his bread and butter, and, you know, he played it with his brother a lot. And, grew up doing that. He played his whole childhood up there. And, ended up going and playing at the University of Toledo and ended up getting drafted by the Oakland Athletics in the 10th round, long story short. And then, ended up meeting my mom here in Huntsville, Alabama, and been here ever since.
So you started out playing at a very young age, and your father was there with you as you were developing into a standout on your own. And a lot of kids dream about the chance just to meet a professional baseball player, but you had someone there with you very close who was actually helping you.
It was awesome. You know, he's kind of been like my pitching coach and just my life coach, obviously being my dad. But, you know, he's always been there for me, been able to teach me life lessons and baseball lessons along the way. And, you know, the impact that he's had on my life and my baseball career is, you know, it's too much to measure. You know, he's I wouldn't be where I'm at without him, that's for sure.
So that's quite the journey, isn't it, Christian, going through the ranks playing Little League Baseball up to where you are today, drafted by a Major League Baseball team. That's amazing. And other than having that talent, though, there is a lot of commitment and hard work involved throughout the whole year, surely. And did this replace things like having a job when you were young and playing amateur baseball?
Yeah, it's a big commitment and everything. Put the time aside to work hard and to, you know, do the things that you have to do to be in good shape. And, you know, there is a lot that goes along with it. So, I mean, compared to working an 8-to-5 job, you know, it never really ends, but you got to be in love with it if you're going to do it.
So what do you think, if there is a youngster out there right now listening to the radio, and Cape Breton surely has its share of boys and girls very talented at baseball and many sports. So anyone who's hoping to take it to the next level as a pitcher, what would you like to say to them to help them develop their craft?
My main thing is, you know, I've been fortunate to come across some great, some really good other pitchers. And my biggest thing was to, when you're around this kind of field, just to be a sponge and soak up as much information as you can from them. You know, I've my dad being one of those people, having professional experience being a pitcher, you know, just being a sponge and soaking up as much information as I can, learning and, you know, using those things. And, you know, honestly, you can even do that by watching TV, you know, watching big league games, college games, whatever it is on TV, you know, just listening to the announcers or just watching pitchers and what they do. You know, you can notice little things and it can impact your game.
And speaking of college baseball, you were instrumental in helping your team, Mississippi State, win the recent College World Series. And in the school's 126-year history, the school wasn't able to bring home a national title until now. And you probably played a large role in that. But what was that experience like in winning the College World Series?
Yeah, so Mississippi State's never won a national championship in anything, you know, no sport, no football or anything like that. So we're the first sport to ever bring home a national championship to Mississippi State. And so, you know, right when we got to campus in the fall time, we're saying amongst the team, you know, we gotta finally win this thing. And, you know, we all worked hard all fall, spring, and, you know, we put in the work, and, you know, we're fortunate to call ourselves the first national champions in Mississippi State.
And the good news and the achievements just kept coming for you. Later, soon after that, you found out you were drafted by the Minnesota Twins. And just before we continue there, Christian, I wanted to have a chance to play your scouting report and what caught the eyes of the big league scouts. And here's your scouting report here. I'm just going to play it here for the listeners.
Though the pandemic limited him to just 4 starts last spring, Cloud tied a Mississippi State freshman record with a pair of double-digit strikeout outings, matching former first-round choices Eric DuBose and Paul Mulholland. McLeod is one of the higher floors among college pitchers in the 2021 class, and a profile similar to that of Reed Detmers, who went 10th overall to the Angels in 2020. McLeod's best pitch is a plus upper 70s curveball with good depth that plays well off his fastball. His heater has below average velocity at 89 to 93 miles an hour, but it is effective because he commands it, tunnels it well with his curve, and has high spin rates and riding length that keep it off barrels. He also has the makings of at least an average changeup in the low 80s with sink. McLeod uses his 6'4" frame and high 3/4" arm slot to create downhill play on his pitches and good extension in his delivery, which he repeats easily. His strength, durability, and efficiency with locating his offerings all enhance his chances at making a big league rotation. He keeps hitters off balance with his ability to sequence his pitches and move them around the strike zone.
So can you take us back to that moment when you found out that you were going to be a professional baseball player?
Yeah, so I was with my family down in Birmingham, Alabama, and you know, got the call from my agent that I was being about to get picked by the Twins, and you know, that was just a really special moment. It all kind of set in, and I realized, you know, the hard work's paying off, but the real work's about to start. You know, it's a small step of my goal of wanting to be a big leaguer one day, and you know, I'm really, really thankful to be selected by a team like the Twins. You know, it's a great organization, and I'm really excited about it.
How do you prepare for this now? A very busy summer ahead for you, and what will the Twins organization expect to see from you when you go to camp?
You know, I'm going to do what I do with my whole career, you know, be a sponge, like I said earlier, and, you know, listen to what they have to say, learn as much as I can, and, you know, I'm going to work as hard as I can for them, work on with my delivery and stuff like that, but, you know, just getting down there, working hard, staying in good shape, and hopefully getting a couple of innings under my belt.
You know, Christian, we appreciate this, you taking the call like this down in Alabama on such short notice, but the cell phone line here isn't very good, and losing some of your comments there, I'd hate to miss out on what you're saying there for now. Maybe we'll put it off till another time, but just thanks so much, and congratulations to you, and maybe there are even some new fans of the Minnesota Twins up here in Cape Breton.
Well, I appreciate that. That means a lot. It's an honor to be able to be on the show and everything, and you know, represent a little bit of where my dad's from. It's a pretty neat opportunity.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.